Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Sexual abuse, assault, and exploitation. Money. Power. A criminal justice system that bends for the wealthy and influential. Those are the driving forces behind the cascade of failures that led to Jeffrey Epstein's death at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. There are many questions surrounding this case, some of which will be answered by investigations and inquiries. But really, how will Epstein's alleged victims find justice now? This hour on Point, where do victims turn when a system fails? And you can join us. What questions do you have on the Epstein case? Do you see systemic failures here? How can victims ever find justice if a case never comes to trial? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today from Washington with Sadie Gurman, Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Sadie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, let me play a little bit of what Attorney General Bill Barr said just yesterday in response, of course, to Jeffrey Epstein's apparent death by suicide. Here he is condemning breaches in protocol at the Manhattan Federal Jail where Epstein died.
I was appalled, and indeed the whole department was, and frankly, angry to learn of the MCC's failure to adequately secure this prisoner. We are now learning of serious irregularities at this facility that are deeply concerning and demand a thorough investigation. We will get to the bottom of what happened, and there will be accountability.
Attorney General Bill Barr there just yesterday. Sadie, tell us a little bit more about what the Attorney General has said about this case thus far.
Well, you know, he hasn't elaborated on the serious irregularities that he mentioned yesterday, but we do know at this point that, contrary to protocol, Epstein was left alone in his cell without a cellmate and was not receiving regular 30-minute checks. So the Attorney General has said, you know, he's angry about this. He wants answers. He's ordered an Inspector General investigation into this, and he is demanding accountability.
I've also seen here that that Epstein's own attorneys requested that he be taken off of suicide watch. Is that correct?
Yes, it's certainly interesting. Not only did they request that he be removed from suicide watch, but he was spending hours a day with them, sometimes up to 12 hours a day.
And that's unusual. That kind of access is unusual for someone in jail to have with their attorneys.
It's just an interesting detail. A sign that he was fully preparing for his criminal case, that they would be meeting for so long.
I see. So do we know any more about why his attorneys requested he be taken off of suicide watch?
You know, we don't. As part of the criminal case, they had argued for him to be held at home instead of in jail. But we're not entirely sure at this point why they wanted him downgraded to, a lesser status.
I see. OK, so tell us more about what the Attorney General or what the Justice Department hopes to do here. I mean, there's going to be an investigation into the circumstances around Epstein's apparent death by suicide. Any other investigations do we know so far?
Well, as the Attorney General said yesterday, the investigation into Epstein's associates is ongoing. He pledged justice for the victims, and he, basically promised that they would continue to investigate this case and said any co-conspirators should not rest easy. So I don't think we've seen the last of the investigations. There's some signs that they are already ongoing. Yesterday, the FBI and police raided Epstein's properties in the Virgin Islands. So there are some indications that in earnest, this investigation is continuing.
Interesting. Well, let's listen to a little bit more, exactly the point that you just made. Let's hear Attorney General Bill Barr himself say it.
Let me assure you that this case will continue on against anyone who was complicit with Epstein. Any co-conspirators should not rest easy. The victims deserve justice, and they will get it.
Again, that's Attorney General Bill Barr yesterday. Sadie, do we know what the attorneys for Epstein's alleged victims have said? What recourse do they wish for now?
Well, they're very disappointed, obviously, that the criminal case against him has died and they won't have a chance to face him directly. But they still have some recourse. There could be federal prosecutors in Manhattan who've been dealing with this case could still seek to seize Epstein's assets. It's, you know, he's very wealthy. He has a lot of properties, including in New York and overseas, or in the Virgin Islands. And so by seizing his property, they could be, you know, filing court documents that could really lay bare even more details of this case. So, you know, we haven't heard the last of this, but I think the victim's attorneys are very disappointed that you know, the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons weren't adequately monitoring this inmate.
Mm-hmm. And Sadie, one more question for you. We have this comment that's come in online on our website from NSTEF. NSTEF says, I find it maddening and highly suspicious that AG Barr is outraged and laser-focused on what happened in the prison, yet he expressed none of the same outrage or investigative vigor when it was clear that then-prosecutor Acosta gave Epstein that deal in Florida back in 2008 without following the law and notifying his accusers. That's from our listener, NSTEF. Has the Justice Department said or made any indication that they would go back and actually have an inquiry or investigation about that 2008 case and deal that NSTEF is referring to?
Well, another arm of the Justice Department, the Office of Professional Responsibility, is looking into that and is looking into the deal that prosecutors hatched back in 2007. So there is some good faith effort, I think, to get to the bottom of this. But Barr has not addressed that directly recently at all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the date correction there, 2007. And that was the deal that led to Epstein serving some 13 months in jail. But he was able to be let out every day for about 12 hours a day to go to his office during that that jail time. But Sadie Gurman, Justice Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from Washington. Sadie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Barbara McQuaid. She joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. She's a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She's a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. She recently wrote an op-ed in the Daily Beast headlined, Jeffrey Epstein's death once again denies his victims justice. Barbara McQuaid, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. So first of all, just give us your reaction. Where is the sort of nexus of failure here in the MCC in Manhattan? Is it unusual what happened around Epstein, or were sort of the pieces in place there in terms of how that that institution has been run for a long time?
Well, I think responsibility falls squarely on the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr. I think he has really pointed the finger at the MCC when, in fact, it's under his watch. He is the head of the Department of Justice. The Bureau of Prisons is part of the Department of Justice. And it appears from at least these early reports that they were understaffed. That's on him. He should make sure that if we're going to lock people up, that you have adequate resources to care for those who are in your custody. And the reports indicate that they were short-staffed. They had people who were working overtime shifts against their will, and even pressing into service people who worked at the facility but in other jobs like secretaries and other things who weren't trained in corrections and were told that they had to keep watch anyway. And so I think that's where I hope we'll see some remedies. You know, in America, we lock up a lot of people. And if we want to do that, we have to ensure that we have adequate resources to do it safely.
So, I mean, this could be a case in terms of the circumstances around Epstein's death. This could be a case of, as you said, lack of resources, poor management, bad decision making. I mean, we've even seen reporting here that says regular protocol at MCC required that Epstein had a cellmate and the guards on duty were supposed to check on them every 30 minutes. But at some point, the cellmate was moved out, according to reporting from CNN here. I mean, is that unusual, or does that kind of thing happen more often? We just don't know about it because it doesn't happen with very high profile inmates.
I think that's right. I think that this will – maybe one benefit of this is to shine a light onto conditions in corrections facilities and suicide in corrections facilities. But Jeffrey Epstein presented a unique challenge in that he was a high-profile child molester, and child molesters often do not fare well in prison. But Bureau of Prisons and all corrections facilities – owe a duty to protect those in their custody. And so they had to know that he was at risk of injury either from others or himself. Inmates you will hear refer to going after chomos. They refer to as child molesters. It is a badge of honor to hurt or kill child molesters in prison, and it happens with some frequency, which is one reason he was likely in the special housing unit mm-hmm. because of his high profile. And so to protect him from other inmates, that's where he was. And as you say, under the suicide protocol at that facility, he was to have a cellmate. A cellmate serves some purpose if he is trying to harm himself. The cellmate can either stop it, can provide some companionship that might prevent it, or can yell for guards to help. I don't know why his cellmate was moved, but that is not an infrequent occurrence. Inmates have to move all the time when they have court dates or for various other reasons of managing the population. And maybe they did not have another appropriate cellmate to put in there with him at that time. But that would just make the need to check on him all that much greater. And so the failure to check on him every 30 minutes, I think, is clearly a lapse in following the protocol.
And Barbara, as you pointed out, we're seeing reports here of guards being overworked. I'm seeing here that one of the guards who is allegedly monitoring Epstein's cell, again, this is according to reporting from CNN, was working mandatory overtime, a mandatory overtime shift. Another was working the fifth overtime shift in the week. Okay, so a lot – there will be investigations on this front, and we'll see what happens when the investigation's findings are revealed, whenever they are. But got a lot more questions for you, Barbara. We just have to take a quick break. We are talking about Jeffrey Epstein's death in a Manhattan correctional facility and the bigger systemic failures that led to that moment and how his alleged victims can find justice now. Find us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the death of Jeffrey Epstein in a Manhattan correctional facility and how his alleged victims can find justice now. We want to hear your questions about this case and your response to how, for example, Attorney General Bill Barr is addressing this moment. I'm joined today by Barbara McQuaid. She's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. She's a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And Barbara, let me play a clip of tape for you here. This is Spencer Coovin, an attorney representing some of Epstein's accusers. He spoke to the Associated Press on Sunday.
There's a certain amount of shock and disbelief that the federal authorities could allow something like this to occur under their watch. We find it very hard to believe that he would be allowed to commit suicide, especially when he was on suicide watch from just a few days ago.
That's Spencer Coovin, an attorney representing some of Epstein's accusers. Barbara, help me understand something. How unusual is it for the counsel for an accused person who had already once, it seems he had already once tried to take his life, request that he be taken off of suicide watch. I mean, that just seems unusual to me.
You know, it's actually a fairly common request. Uh-huh. Suicide watch is not a pleasant scenario for inmates, and they often don't want to be on suicide watch. They are observed more frequently. I know at least in some facilities, they have to wear different prison garb that's very uncomfortable. But the point is it can't be shredded into strips that can be used to make a noose. And so it's a very thick, heavy felt garment that they wear. And so I am sure a defense attorney is not seeking to make it easier for the inmate to commit suicide. But if a client says, look, I'm not suicidal anymore, I never was, and this is not comfortable for me, it's inhibiting my ability to prepare my defense, to be comfortable, I have seen defense attorneys make that request in the past.
I see. Okay. So – In Epstein's case, I mean, he had already tried once, right? Or at least seemed to have tried once. And from the perspective of the prison authorities, certainly a defense counsel can come and say, we'd like you to take our client off suicide watch. It seems as if they were that prison authorities were wrong to have acquiesced to that request.
Yes. And the defense attorney does not really get the final say. They make that request, but I don't know that it is all that meaningful. Each facility under the Bureau of Prisons has its own plan for dealing with suicides. And it changes and varies depending on the population that it deals with, the facility, and its resources. But there are some commonalities in all of them. And it is not uncommon for people to go on and off suicide watch from time to time. But to go off suicide watch, you must have an in-person interview face-to-face with the program coordinator, who must be a psychologist. And so I don't know whether that happened, but that person makes an assessment whether the person is believed to be a danger. The other thing that would cause someone to go on short-term suicide watch is if they've had a so-called bad day in court. They've been to court and received devastating news. It might be for just a day or two you put someone on suicide watch for that reason. And we know in this case, on Friday,
yes,
the very day that Epstein took his life, there was a release of thousands of pages of documents with great detail about his sex trafficking. And so it would seem that that was a day when they should have been on heightened alert.
This was the release of the previously sealed documents in the Maxwell case you're referring to.
Yes. And it had a lot of detail that had to have been personally humiliating to Epstein about his conduct with many of his victims.
Okay. Well, I want to now turn really to the question of where do victims seek justice now? So first of all, let's listen to Eric Fudali, a victims' rights attorney at the Bloom Firm, which represents some of Epstein's accusers. He spoke to CBS News over the weekend, and Fudali read a statement from one of his clients. He didn't identify which one, but here's that statement.
I will never have a sense of closure now. I'm angry as hell that the prison could have allowed this to happen and that I and his other victims will never see him face the consequences for his horrendous actions. I hope that whoever allowed this to happen also faces some type of consequence. You stole from us the huge piece of healing that we needed to move on with our lives.
All right, Barbara. So that is Eric Fudali, a counsel representing one of Epstein's accusers. You just wrote this piece called Jeffrey Epstein's Death Once Again Denies His Victims Justice. Explain to us how you think they've been denied justice.
Well, they'd already been denied justice in the first instance when the Southern District of Florida entered into that plea agreement that you mentioned earlier and violated their rights under the Crime Victims' Rights Act by not providing them with notice of that deal before it was entered, even proactively misleading them into believing that federal charges were still likely in that case. But now here, once again, they're denied their opportunity to go to court and confront him with all of the harm that he has perpetrated against them. They have some other remedies, you know, civil lawsuits. They may be able to get some money through forfeiture of his home, through damages against his estate. But they will lose that opportunity to stand in open court and face him face to face, make him listen in front of the public and tell them all the ways that he has harmed their lives. You know, here in Michigan, last summer, we had a chance to see that in action in the Larry Nassar case, the doctor to USA Gymnastics at Michigan State University. And we saw young woman after young woman come in and describe in detail what he had done to her and the impact that that had had on their lives. And I think that went a very long way to their own healing, as well as educating the public about just how harmful these kinds of crimes are. They've lost that opportunity. And even if they can get money through restitution and other things, they're never going to have that same opportunity that has now been denied to them.
And also, with Epstein now dead, even as the Justice Department seeks to move forward with investigating the conspiracy, conspiracy meaning the sex trafficking conspiracy, the abuse conspiracy that he was at the heart of, they've lost the primary source of information about that. They've lost Epstein himself.
Yeah, which may very well have been part of a motive for his death. He obviously is the one who knows best. I appreciate that the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York made a statement on Saturday saying that the investigation will continue and noting that it included a conspiracy count. They allege employees and associates assisted in the sex trafficking crimes. So that's gratifying. I also note that the FBI conducted a search on the Island home on Monday, which, again, I think is an effort to race family members or associates to that location to get any evidence that might be there before it can be destroyed or removed. So that suggests a seriousness to all of it. But yeah, as you point out, the person who really knows everyone who was involved, including those who patronized the girls, which right. is a crime under the sex trafficking statute, they've lost a really important source of information in Jeffrey Epstein, who will take with him the names and identities and conduct of those to his grave.
You know, just this morning I read a column in the New York Times from James Stewart. He actually visited Epstein in his Manhattan home last year. This New York Times columnist visited Epstein. And to your point, Barbara, about the victims losing their opportunity to confront Epstein in court and communicate to him directly the harm and damage that he caused. I mean, last year to this Times columnist, Jeffrey Epstein was still saying he was saying he didn't actually He thought that laws that prevented sexual contact with underage girls were wrong, that those laws were antiquated notions of human behavior. So I'm not sure. I mean, this is all speculation now, but I'm not sure what effect that the confrontation or the victim's ability to confront Epstein would have had on them, on him. Do you see what I'm saying? Like it would have helped them, which is important. But it wouldn't have had any impact on him, it doesn't seem.
Well, maybe not. And, you know, if he is a, you know, he's presumed innocent until convicted. But upon conviction, making him listen to those things, I think perhaps could convince him. But, you know, it's not about convincing him. It's right. about giving the girls an opportunity to explain why it is harmful to them. They're not adults. I read that same interview and he equated it to homosexuality, which at one time and in some places still is illegal. And it's just because we are not yet as enlightened as we should be. Children are underage, do not have the ability to form the kinds of judgment necessary to make those decisions for themselves. In gay sex, if you have adults making their own decisions, that's a very different thing. And so he manipulated these girls by turning their heads with payments and promises of modeling careers. He was a cool older guy who made them feel special. And for that reason, accepted in getting involved in these sex acts, which they now say themselves that they regret and feel victimized by. And so it may have paid for him to listen to that. But beyond him and convincing him, it convinces society and explains to others why this is serious and harmful conduct. And perhaps, one hopes, it changes opinions and minds of others who might be like-minded with the Jeffrey Epsteins of the world.
Let's get a quick call here. Tama is calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Tama, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. As a child sexual abuse survivor myself, whose perpetrator died before he could be confronted, I feel the pain of Epstein's victims. My perpetrator had no money, so there's nothing to be done for me. But there is something we can all do. instead of covering similar abuses in other countries, such as the disappeared Native American women and others that we've been reporting on, we should be looking inward. We should be looking at our own behavior and then do something to prevent similar crimes in the future. I can't undo the harm that was done to me, but I can talk about it and hopefully bring this rampant behavior out into the light of day so that it doesn't happen again.
Tama, thank you so much for your call. Barbara, would you have a response or a thought for Tama?
Yeah, I really appreciate her courage in coming forward, because it's hearing stories like that that I think encourages other survivors to come forward and confront their own demons. You know, so often children are victimized by family members, loved ones, family friends, faith leaders, and told that you have to keep it secret. If you don't, you know, I will harm you. No one will believe you. All sorts of nonsense like that. And they carry these heavy burdens with them for many, many years. And so I think when people like Tama speak up with courage, it empowers other survivors to do the same. And that is the way to defeat this crime, is to confront it and call it out.
Well, I want to talk for a moment a little bit more in more detail about the options that that Epstein's accusers, that victims have now. Let's talk a little bit more about the co-conspirators, right? That the Justice Department is looking at. If I understand correctly, there were several people identified in that 2007-2008 Florida agreement, so certainly the Justice Department ought to be looking, or is looking, at them right now.
Yeah, I would think so. Some were named by name. And one of the very unusual provisions of that Southern District of Florida plea agreement is that it also provided immunity to, quote, any potential co-conspirators. That's a very unusual provision to include, because it immunizes people who are not yet known or identified, no matter what conduct they've engaged in. That was one of the provisions that really caused me to scratch my head about that agreement in the first place. Of course, that is only binding against that U.S. Attorney's office. And so the Southern District of New York has taken on this case and has vowed to identify employees and associates who were involved. And so there are, we know, based on the deposition documents released on Friday, at least a butler and a pilot. We know there is Ghislaine Maxwell, who was at one time Jeffrey Epstein's girlfriend. Some refer to her as his madam, who was involved in procuring the girls, allegedly. Some of those people. But I would also urge the Southern District of New York to look not just at those who were procuring girls, but also those who were patronizing them. The sex trafficking statute makes it a crime to patronize underage children who have been procured commercially. And so I would want to look for all of those people as well. Sometimes the so-called Johns are not charged. They are overlooked, and you move on to those who were sort of organizers. But to the extent these were people with vast resources who were driving the criminal conduct, I would want to talk to them. And I think, depending on their conduct, even consider charging them.
Okay. So about Ghislaine Maxwell here, first of all, I want to play a little bit of tape from a video that the Miami Herald published yesterday. And by the way, we should mention that Julie K. Brown's reporting from the Miami Herald, really, our hats off to her, because she didn't give up on this story. And her three-part series last year really sort of opened it all up again. And it's what got the Southern District of New York interested in looking at Epstein once again. So the importance of dogged investigative reporting there. I want to acknowledge the Miami Herald's role in all of this. But in a video from the Herald yesterday, Virginia Roberts Gouffray, one of Epstein's victims, or alleged victims, she talked about Ghislaine Maxwell and talked about an alleged plan that Maxwell had for Gouffray to have a baby for Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein.
Ghislaine, you know, starts talking to me about how would I feel about having a child? What? Having a baby? Yeah, it would be your baby, but it would really be our baby. And we would have you sign a document that says that you would have an allowance. We would pay you $200,000 a month, and you would have a nice house. But this child is really ours, and we can do what we want to do with our child. You could basically never take this child from us.
That's Virginia Roberts Gouffre talking about Ghislaine Maxwell. Barbara McQuaid, just to remind folks, Maxwell is the person that a lawsuit was brought against. That was the big unsealing, the big document dump on Friday regarding a case against Maxwell. I'm seeing here, CBS News is reporting, that Maxwell's current location is unknown. She's a British socialite originally before she came to the United States. That's got to be concerning.
Yeah, and that makes it very difficult for law enforcement. Finding her wherever she is might not be the hardest part. If they can locate her somewhere around the world and they can tap into – the FBI has legal attachés all over the world. But it depends very much on which country she's in, whether they might be able to get their hands on her. She could be charged in the United States if her conduct occurred here or was part of a conspiracy occurring here. And it sounds like, at least based on some of these allegations, it was. And then you'd have to find her. And then you would have to attempt to extradite her. And that can be very challenging depending on the country. Some countries are great about it. We have extradition treaties. It can take a bit of time, but ultimately can get them there. Others, depending on where she is, as we saw with Edward Snowden, are beyond our reach.
Well, Barbara McQuaid, stand by for just a second. Barbara is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, and we are talking about Jeffrey Epstein's death and how victims can find justice now. Find us online at Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio or our website, onpointradio.org, where someone calling themselves Gumby says, "Give me a break, the most important person in custody, and this happens." We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Jeffrey Epstein's apparent death by suicide in a Manhattan correctional facility and how his victims, how his accusers find justice. Now, I've been joined this hour by Barbara McQuaid. She's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, now a professor at the University of Michigan Law School and a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. And let's get a couple of calls in here. Tricia is calling from Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Tricia, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Well, I agree with the earlier point that Bill Barr should be held responsible for his poor oversight of our federal prisons. Should he now recuse himself from overseeing any Epstein investigation because his father had been one of the early employers of Epstein, drawing him to teach at a private school and placing those kids at risk?
So, Tricia, you're referring to Bill Barr's father, Donald Barr, right, who was apparently the headmaster at the Dalton School where Jeffrey Epstein many decades ago taught math. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So, Tricia, let me just turn that question quickly to Barbara. Is that a conflict of interest, Barbara McQuaid, that Bill Barr might have here?
Probably not sufficient to trigger the DOJ recusal rules. I think William Barr did recuse himself from review of the Alex Acosta plea agreement because he was at the Kirkland and Ellis firm, which was involved in representing Jeffrey Epstein at that time. But I think he has remained involved in the larger things. You know, ordinarily it is if you have some sort of allegiance with employment, family members, or politics, you are supposed to recuse. It strikes me as probably too remote, but there is also a provision that if there's even the appearance of a conflict of interest, because it's not just direct conflicts, but perceptions of conflict of interest that can undermine trust in the justice system. And so you should still consult with DOJ ethics officials even in these not just must recuse situations, but should recuse situations.
So you're suggesting that Bill Barr ought to do that? I mean, Trisha's already implying that there, in her mind at least, there is the appearance of a conflict.
I think so. And also to the extent that, you know, he's the boss here and is on the hook for this lapse, I think that might be another reason that his reputation is on the line here and perhaps recusal might be appropriate.
All right, let's go to George, who's calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. George, you're on the air.
Meghna, Barbara, I appreciate you taking my phone call. And I guess I'm really kind of directing this towards Barbara, is that with Epstein now being out of the picture, I think we don't have the opportunity to really look inside Pandora's box, because I think we're missing something here in terms of the fact that, yes, there was child molestation going on. Yes, he was probably the biggest pimp in America. But we're also missing the fact that his associationships and the people that he hung with and ran with and participated in what he was doing. And I guess what I'm looking down the gun barrel is he was an associate of our president. And why not silence someone who was termed as a weak link before he could be brought to trial and maybe expose everybody and everything that was going on? Because, number one, the prior sentence was allowing him to get out for 12 hours a day to go to the office to do what he was going to do. This time, he's in a jail.
Yeah.
He's locked up. He's afraid, and he's saying, am I going to be here for years? And those on the outside and some of the names that have been implicated with him are saying, we can't let him speak up.
So, George, I'm going to take it back from you, not to cut you off here, but I want to engage with this question that you're asking. And Barbara, since George directed this question directly to you, I'll give you a quick shot at it. But we've also got another guest who can talk with us about this. But what do you think about what George has said? The internet is rife with these questions about could Epstein not have taken his own life?
Well, that is something that will certainly be investigated. I think he did have a treasure trove of potentially of information about associates. And I do note that in addition to the inspector general, which investigates failures to follow procedures and recommendations for improvements to procedures, investigating this case, William Barr says the FBI is also investigating. And so they investigate crimes and only crimes. And so are they looking to see whether Jeffrey Epstein did not commit suicide, but was perhaps murdered by a fellow inmate or a guard? I imagine that those are the kinds of things that they are looking at to see whether there is any foul play. I don't think there's any evidence of foul play at this time, but certainly questions about it that make it worthwhile for the FBI to check that out.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Joseph Uzinski. He joins us from Miami, Florida. He's a professor of political science at the University of Miami and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. Joseph Uzinski, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your patience as well.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so George got us to a major part of the overall story that the Epstein case is bringing to us now. I mean, as I pointed out, there are many conspiracy theories regarding Epstein and his death at the moment. What do you make of that? Is that a product of this case in particular, or sort of the information ecosystem or disinformation ecosystem we all live in now? What do you think?
Well, my email inbox is full of Georges, each with their own little theory about what may have happened, and not just for this particular set of conspiracy theories, but for pretty much any time anyone dies, even sometimes when people don't die, there's conspiracy theories to explain it. There's nothing new here. Anytime there's something big in the news, people who have a conspiratorial worldview want to attach a theory to it. And in that way, it's sort of like fan fiction. Just like when Game of Thrones was coming to an end, you know, before the final season started, everyone was making a little video on YouTube that says, here's what I think's going to happen. And all of them were wrong. And that's sort of how conspiracy theories are, is they all posit their own explanation of what happened or what will happen. And pretty much they're almost all wrong.
Well, you know, I mean, the simplest explanation is usually the right one, right? And we'll have the investigations into finding out exactly what happened to Epstein here. But Joseph, I got to ask you, In Epstein's case, and in the case of other wealthy, extremely wealthy, influential individuals who are facing trial, some of whom who die before trial, others who don't, don't we have the conspiracy theories can rush in here because we have evidence that these are already people who in their own ways beat the system or the system allowed them to beat it. Like I'm thinking about that 2007-2008 deal that he got in Florida. I mean, he got that Florida because he was well connected, really wealthy, and who knows what other information he had that people wanted to keep out of the press or out of the courts. That is the space. The truth is where conspiracy theories begin, isn't it?
No, well, it's completely unfalsifiable nonsense because he's so wealthy and well-connected that he had to sign a plea deal. If he was wealthy and well-connected, it never would have come up in the first place. If he was wealthy and well-connected, he never would have been in jail this time. We wouldn't even know who this guy is or there never would have been any charges against him ever. So conspiracy theorists always walk this line where he's so wealthy and powerful that he gets arrested and winds up in jail without bail.
Barbara McCoy. Okay. Well, no. I guess what I'm saying is that I'm not giving credence to any of the specific conspiracy theories out there right now. But what I'm saying is that people come around to maybe thinking perhaps some of it is true because we do have evidence that powerful folks, the criminal justice system bends for them a little bit.
No.
Okay.
I mean, that may be the case that the criminal justice bends that way. I mean, that's out of my area of expertise. But the circumstances of what happened don't really matter that much and don't give conspiracy theorists so much credit. I mean, when Scalia died, we had the same sort of hubbub from the right thinking that Obama had him killed. And they just wouldn't look at the fact that a overweight guy with diabetes who was a heavy smoker and almost 80 could die on his own. And the evidence that they held on to was the fact that there was a pillow found near his head. And they interpreted it as the pillow was stuffed onto his head with Obama's handprints on it. So this is going to happen no matter what the details are. So if somebody big in the news dies, there are going to be a certain segment of people who say there must have been a plot here. And what's making this big now is that you have people on both sides of the political aisle who can jump on it and blame each other.
Well, one of those people, I mean, I'm actually glad you mentioned the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, because one of the people who talked about the pillow being on Justice Scalia's face was Donald Trump, right? And he, in the wake of Epstein's death, also through his Twitter account, once again pushed out some of the conspiracy theories around Epstein's death. In this case, you know, allegations involving the Clintons. So, I mean, only a couple of hours after Epstein was found death, this happened. The president retweeted a message tying Epstein's death to former President Bill Clinton. I'm just trying to be more specific here. Kellyanne Conway, White House counselor, spoke to Fox News' Bill Hemmer on Sunday, and she defended the president's retweet.
Why did the president then retweet that Clinton suggestion?
I think the president just wants everything to be investigated, as your reporter just revealed just the day before. There was some unsealed information implicating some people very high up. And I'm not going to repeat their names. You already did that. I'm not saying anything beyond that, and I won't.
That's Kellyanne Conway speaking to Fox News on Sunday. So, Professor Yuzinski, what impact does it have that the president of the United States is channeling some of these theories?
It's bad. And, you know, conspiracy theories ruminate quite a bit on their own when they get elites to channel them and then the mainstream media to channel them, too. It's not good because he can reach a lot more people than somebody at the water cooler can. Mm. But we've known this for years. I mean, he started out with the birther theory, and then during the primaries, he said that Ted Cruz's dad killed JFK. So this is completely par for the course. I mean, Trump built a coalition of people who are enamored with conspiracy theories, among other things, and he has to dance with the one who brought him to the prom. And he has – so by that, he keeps speaking the language of his core supporters, and that's conspiracy theories is one of those things. So he sort of has to do this.
Barbara McQuaid, As a former U.S. attorney, do you look at these conspiracy theories as potentially problematic in terms of how the public might absorb the findings of the inquiries and investigations when they come out around Epstein's death?
It is problematic in that it could taint a future jury pool. So if, for example, you want to charge certain individuals, whether it's Ghislaine Maxwell or those who patronized the girls along with Jeffrey Epstein, you worry that in the back of their minds are these conspiracy theories that make it harder perhaps for them to get a fair trial or for the government to get a fair trial if they think that there was some sort of foul play that intervened here. And so that's the harm that I see as you try to pursue justice in a case like this, is that all this nonsense swirls around out there and can taint jurors. Although typically judges are able to use the jury selection process in high-profile cases to ask appropriate questions to weed people out who might ascribe to some of those types of conspiracy theories. But that's the harm.
Well, let's go to a call here. Mike is calling from Glen Falls, New York. Mike, you're on the air. Hey, Mike, your cell phone line is really, really breaking up on us. We can't hear you. We'll try to get back to you or try to call us back because I want to get your call in the air, but we can't hear you at the moment. But try again. Let's go to City, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. City, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, like, I don't subscribe to any conspiracy theories. And when you look at the evidence, you can even see that, you know, many people on Suicide Watch do indeed commit suicide. But I also want to add on to that point where a lot of conspiracy theories are based on, like, a kernel of truth. And I think it's up to, obviously, the great work you guys are doing in investigative journalism to pretty much just uncover that. So I hope the people, the perpetrators, get what's coming to them, and I hope the victims get justice. Thank you.
City, thank you for your call. Professor Yuzinski, you want to respond to City?
Yeah, he sounds sort of level-headed.
Thankfully, I guess.
Which is a rarity these days, so it doesn't always happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, Barbara McQuaid, I want to turn back to a moment to that initial plea deal from Florida. Because I guess what I was trying to get at with Professor Yuzinski is that we do have a set of facts at hand regarding the deal that Epstein managed to get through excellent legal representation back in 2007 in Florida, which I think it's pretty well accepted now. It was unusually lenient. I do still have a question about how the wealthy and the powerful can sometimes get outcomes that aren't available to the rest of us. I mean, shouldn't we be concerned that if we're talking about failures in the justice system, failures that are continuing to harm victims, that we ought to be looking back at what Epstein secured for himself in 2007?
Yes. I mean, justice should be the same regardless of the resources of the defendant who's involved. Now, that is the way it's supposed to work. I think most prosecutors with integrity work very hard to ensure that that's how it works. But the reality is that there are disparities in the criminal justice system based on the resources, because people who can afford aggressive lawyers who have lots of time just get better legal representation. Now, I shouldn't say it's the quality of the lawyers. There are some phenomenal people doing public defense. Most public defenders are phenomenal. They're just overworked. They have such large caseloads that they are not able to devote the kind of resources that well-financed lawyers can. So when lawyers are making $1,000 an hour and there's no limit to the number of hours they can bill, they will do what's known as papering you to death. They will file motion after motion. Sometimes they'll even go after the prosecutors and try to investigate their personal lives to extort them into good deals. Now, one of the things Alex Acosta said was that his assistant prosecutors were being investigated in that way, and it's one of the reasons that he resolved the case. That should never happen. Instead of succumbing to that kind of pressure, prosecutors should call it out and fight against it.
Well, Barbara McQuaid, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, and a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Magna.
And Joseph Uzinski, professor of political science at the University of Miami and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. Professor Uzinski, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.